There's something nice about, like, you get the experience of accumulating all of it and, like, learning about it and the hunt and whatever, but then you can just, like, you can let it go. Like, you've had it, you've had your enjoyment with it, and you let it go.
No kidding around. You just simplistically put it, you just made it simple. That is exactly it. The joy is in, it's acquiring it, learning about it, and then going, okay, I don't need this anymore. And by the way, and I know your readers know this and your listeners, it's all about joy.
Yeah.
What brings you joy?
Hey everybody, I'm your host Stephen Pulverin, and this is Hodinkee Radio. This week, we've got a super special guest for you. You're going to hear my conversation with comedy legend Jeff Garlin. You might know Jeff as Jeff Green from HBO's Curb Your Enthusiasm, as Murray Goldberg from ABC's The Goldbergs, or just from his storied stand-up comedy career. Jeff and I were introduced through a mutual friend in the photography world, but we quickly realized that we had lots of other passions in common too. We love music, we love comedy, we love collecting, and of course, we love watches. He's relatively new to the watch world, though, and he got into it through an interesting backstage encounter with a comedy great, but I'm going to let him tell that story. And just as a note, this conversation was recorded back at the end of May. Obviously, a lot has happened between then and now, and the general mood in the air is a bit different, so if my tone or Jeff's tone sounds a little weird for right now, that's why. It's still a fantastic chat, and I know you're going to love it. So without further ado, let's do this.
Are you in your house?
Yeah, I'm in my apartment.
Where is your apartment?
I am on the Upper East Side. I'm all the way by the East River.
Oh, yeah. Delightful.
Yeah, it's good. You know, it's a very New York apartment. It's a fifth floor walk-up studio.
You don't get me. Well, no, there's only one thing that could make your apartment more New York is the bathroom in the hallway.
No, it's like in its own corner. It's not in the kitchen.
Okay, so you have a bathroom in your apartment.
We do have a bathroom, yes. We have an actual bathroom. Okay. Yeah.
Okay, but you know, you've seen those.
Oh, yeah.
I remember a friend of mine, she had a fifth floor walk up. And the bathroom was in the hallway.
Oof, yeah,
so
no.
That's the ultimate. That's like, no, wow.
We have our own bathroom, thankfully. We have friends who live in the East Village whose shower is in their kitchen.
Right.
Which is insane.
By the way, the same person who had the bathroom in the hallway, she had her shower in the kitchen.
Yeah, can't do that. Too old for that shit. Can't swing that anymore.
But remember, though, when you were young and that was not a problem.
Yeah, it would have been fine.
It's like, okay. Yeah.
Would have been fine.
Yeah. You're a man. You had to move on.
Exactly.
That's for boys.
Mostly I have a wife who I think would really not tolerate that. That would not go over well.
Well, no, but that goes to show how much, and this is the truth, women are much smarter than we are.
Very true.
When we aspire to be enlightened, inspire to be great men, we're going to do something stupid because we're men.
True.
That's it. Nothing more. Yeah. I love podcasts. They're delightful.
Glad to hear that. You had your own podcast for a while, right?
I did. I believe when I can, I'm going to start up again. I've got my agents working on it. The same.
Great.
I've got two podcasts planning, one about Curb Your Enthusiasm and one called By the Way, which is what I used to do. I'm bringing it back.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, yeah, we'll talk about photography, we'll talk about watches, we'll talk about comedy.
No, don't tell me anything.
All right.
Don't tell me anything.
Perfect.
Go.
Great.
Go. I'm ready.
Let's do it. It's good to see you, Jeff.
Great to see you.
Things are good out west, out in LA?
Things are great in LA, yes. I'm quite content in my home. I'm content not leaving. I have plenty of things to keep me occupied, and I have my delightful little dog. I don't know where she went, but she's been saving my life. She's the dog. She's my dog. This is crazy. My dog is the dog from the Goldbergs. She was sitting on my lap for 7 years. And then I say to her trainer, can you help me find a dog? I'm living by myself. I think I love dogs. I think it'd be great if I, she goes, what about Sage? That's her name. And I said, what are you talking about? I've been asking about her for years. The woman who owned her, I guess, got another dog that fought with Sage. So she got rid of Sage, but she still gets the money when Sage works, whatever. Long story short, my dog on the Goldbergs is actually my dog and lives with me.
That's amazing.
I have never heard that before. Ever. Yeah.
That's pretty wild. So the dog was your dog on TV for 7 years and then became your dog? It
became my real dog.
That's incredible.
Incredible. And by the way, the dog, because my character's always in his underwear sitting in a Barker lounger, my dog has had plenty of practice of sitting with me in my underwear.
So other than sitting with your dog in your underwear, what are you doing to stay busy these days?
Well, let's see. I aspire to get good at guitar. I aspire to prune my guitars. I've done a good job of that. Still in the middle of a little pruning. I aspire to clean up all my clothes and be real specific. Not clean up as in put away. I'm very clean. I just sometimes might not be neat, but I'm pretty neat too. Which was not me as a boy, but as a man, when you have a home, I feel responsible. I keep it very clean. And so I'm really, I collect baseball cards. I collect guitars, cameras, because I'm a photographer, so I have a lot of cameras. I actually pruned my cameras. I got rid of lenses and cameras that I don't use anymore. I actually have a shelf in my living room, a series of shelves that I'm putting stuff on to give to people.
Mm, that's great.
That's to give to people. And other ones, I have friends who own photography shops and friends who own guitar shops. One in particular, a guitar shop, Imperial Vintage. And I just sent them my guitars. And I said, you pay me what you want to pay me for them. I want you to stay in business. It's tough times and I'm good. I just need to clear these out because in order for me to enjoy anything, it has to be simple and minimal. Mm. I aspire to be, I'm a failure, but I aspire to be a minimalist. I have comic books too. I just started with watches. So I'm playing the guitar. I'm writing comedy. I'm pitching comedy shows, believe it or not. I have 5 shows that are in various stages of development that pretty much got developed all during this period.
That's incredible. So you're keeping busy.
I am keeping busy.
Good.
I am unfortunately alone. I mean, fortunately, a lot of times. I'll never live with anyone again. I'll never. By the way, I love my children. I have 2 boys, 20 and 24. I actually love my ex-wife. Love her so much. But I am now at a point, and I have a home, not an ostentatious, it's a 1962 home, so it's kind of modern architecture, but it's simple, and it's the perfect size for me and everything about it, so I'm happy living alone. It was really funny. I've been, I don't want to say courting somebody on this, but I've met somebody during this period, which is so weird. And I don't want to even get in there, but I want to just say it's very nice to develop a friendship with somebody and see how that goes. But I was telling her about my house and giving her like a tour. This is recently. And she said, I hope you don't take this personal, but I don't ever want to live with anybody again. And a big smile hit my face. I said, I don't want to live with anyone again. I don't mind staying over, even a week or two, whatever. But I love having your own home is pretty delightful. However, when I was living with my wife and my boys, so much of that was delightful too. And I don't have any regrets about that. I love that. I love my family. Yeah.
It's good to know. It's good to know what works for you.
Yeah, it's good. By the way, this is a great time to go, hey man, this is what works for me. These guitars I play, these watches, by the way, I haven't worn a watch during this whole period, but these watches are the ones I'm going to keep. These are the ones I'm going to give to my sons now. These are the ones I'm going to give to friends. I don't really have anything now in my collection, which will be so disappointing for your readers, where I would sell it. You know, I love giving stuff away. Oh, also, by the way, I have a room that's not only filled with my guitars, but all my record albums. I collect vinyl. I have a nice stereo system that I really enjoy. So I've been pruning the albums too. It's so much fun.
There's something nice about, like, you get the experience of accumulating all of it and, like, learning about it and the hunt and whatever, but then you can just, like, you can let it go. Like, you've had it, you've had your enjoyment with it, and you let it go.
By the way, no kidding around, you just simplistically put it, you just made it simple. That is exactly it. The joy is in, it's a fewfold. It's acquiring it, learning about it, which is huge, learning about it and then going, okay, I don't need this anymore. This is not necessary to bring. And by the way, and I know your readers know this and your listeners, it's all about joy.
Yeah.
What brings you joy? It's not about, like, I also collect photography. Mm-hmm. And I was sitting in my living room the other day looking at all my photography, and I have some very nice photography. And I'm like going, you know what? I'm just pointing at a random picture going, yeah, that one I don't need. That one I bought as a collectible piece, and it's worth a lot, but it's not something I feel like gotta have. Mm.
That's a good thing to know about yourself. I think that's something, like, we hear all the time, and I talk to collectors and people in this world all the time who can't get to that stage. Like, they need to hold on to stuff, and they don't know why. They just, like, need it, and they never get to that stage where they can say, like, okay, we're going to bring some things in, we're going to let some things go, and then kind of, like, repeat the process.
It's so, by the way, that is part of the process for me. That is so damn joyful.
Yeah.
To go through that and know, because then it lets you really focus on what you have and enjoy that.
That's true. Yeah. All right. Let's get into photography. I want to talk about photography because that's how we got connected, is through our friends at Leica. Shout out to Kieran, who connected us, who connects me to most great people I know. But how did
Kieran, you... Kieran's fantastic, but everyone at Leica, by the way, you know how, like, look, I have a lot of camera equipment that I paid pretty much full price for. Occasionally I get this much of a discount, not an exaggeration. And Leica's expensive, but it's beautiful. It's beautiful. It's like a Gibson guitar. Mm-hmm. Whereas Fender makes great guitars, and my favorite guitar of all time is probably a Fender Telecaster. But Gibson, they're works of art. Mm-hmm. Leica, their cameras are works of art. And I also have the Hodinkee camera.
Yeah, which is love. That's incredible.
Yeah, I love that camera. It's beautiful.
Thank
so
you.
Interesting. I never knew watches fade that way. I didn't know that.
It's pretty cool to see when we launched the camera, we had the watch that inspired it side by side with the camera in a little glass case for people to see. And Leica did an incredible job, like, really nailing that match. It's not an easy thing to do, and they really nailed it.
Well, the magic of being handmade.
Yeah.
It's like from, you know.
Yeah. How did you first get interested in photography? I actually don't know your sort of, like, origin story.
What I was going to say was, we're talking about how nice everybody is.
Oh, yeah.
So you meet somebody in a corporate environment sometimes, of events or whatever. Every person I've met from Leica is from the stores to the people that work here in New Jersey or they work in Germany. The best people.
Yeah.
And they're passionate. They're passionate, which is what I love about something like that. Now, it works for me as a tool. What I did was, look, I always loved photography. My mother used to tell me, well, I knew this, two of my uncles, my grandfather's brothers on my mom's side, were photographers.
Oh.
They weren't photojournalists, but they were photographers. And I always loved photography, love magazines, big into magazines. My collection's gone down, but all different types, Look and Life and just anywhere for photography. I just sit for hours, love it. And then I decided, I was in my early 40s, which is later in life, you know, and I'm like, I'm getting a camera. Well, the first camera I got was a Nikon camera. I love to take the photograph, you know, all because of the Paul Simon song. There was no Kodachrome, or there were down to very few, so I didn't never use Kodachrome. So I got a Nikon F100.
Okay.
That I still have. I'm looking for the proper person to give it to, I swear, who will get, you know. So anyhow, over time, I used every other brand of camera, meaning I'd have a connection here, a connection there. Oh, I'm using Olympus. Oh, I'm using Panasonic. Oh, I'm using Canon. I've gone through all of them. Sony, because the Goldbergs is a Sony show.
Okay.
So early on when they started doing cameras the right way, they would give me cameras or I'd get them at a great discount, all that. But Leica is, shooting with a Leica is unique, in a unique experience that connects you. Whether or not you're shooting film, digital, doesn't matter. The way you approach, and I'm talking most specifically with an M, an M camera, which is their model that they've had since, I think, 1953. You're involved, and there's a simplicity that's completely unique to it.
Yeah.
And it's a feeling that's unique, and it connects you. So I started shooting with Leica. I moved my way through like their auto camp, like all sorts of different, and I worked my way to an M9. I wasn't around during the M8 period, but M9, I started shooting Leica around the beginning of M9, but I didn't get one right away. It took me a couple of years to get my first M9. And my favorite camera of all time is the Leica MP, which is a film camera, black paint. And then I discovered from using lots of lenses on an M camera, I'm a 35 and 50 person. Those are my favorite lenses. I have a 75 and I have a 24, and those are pretty delightful. I don't have to use the 24 and the 75.
Okay.
I got a lot of them. But 35 millimeter and the simplicity of it. And here's the joke of the whole thing, man. I had no goals. Like when I became a comedian, I wanted to become a famous comedian. That was like, I want to be great. Great was number one. Respected by my peers. Great and respected by my peers. And then a comedy star, per se. But when I started photography, and even after I got an M9 and I started doing it and going, you might be good at this, like in the back of my head, never had goals. Truly, I did a workshop at Leica, a black and white film workshop. And that we were looking at our work, and it was the first time my work was ever seen amongst any people. Like I didn't even show my wife. I didn't show people my work because I'm learning and I'm developing, but I had no goals. So I'm in this class and I'm a wreck. Now I can go on stage in front of 1,000 people, whatever, with nothing prepared and know that I can do an hour and be funny. Well, hopefully be funny. I'm confident in that way. Well, I felt like throwing up when they were about to show pictures after the weekend. And then I got applause from my pictures. Applause. No one got applause in the class. What the hell? Are they doing this because I'm a famous comedian? Like, what's going on? And then I get told by the people that work in the shop, including the woman who runs the gallery, who says, we'd be very interested in doing a show with you. Now, I do know it helps them draw people in if the person who has the show is well-known, for sure. But I wanted to earn any stripe that I got.
Yeah.
Earn. And then I didn't know until I did my show this past January at Leica that I would even be a photographer that people would dig.
Yeah.
People were buying my pictures. You don't hang a picture in somebody's house because they're famous.
Right.
I mean, except, you know, if I'm Rodney Dangerfield or Robin Williams, like you'd have to be like the top of the top to hang a mediocre picture in your house. And then as a talking point, you go, oh, that's Richard Pryor's photograph that he took. for me, I have to earn if I'm hanging in someone's house.
And the work is great. I'm personally a fan of the work. I mean, it's the show was called Big Bowl of Wonderful, right?
Yep.
Where did that where did that name come from?
It came from Paris Chong, who runs the gallery, telling me I had 2 minutes to come up with a name that I hadn't spent the past month that she's been asking me for a name. So I sat at her desk and I went, Big Bowl of Wonderful.
Perfect.
It's like a thing I say. Big Bowl is something that I've been saying for years. And then I've been saying, I said it on Curb. I said it on Curb on occasion, my character. And so it just worked. And I love the title. And that'll be the name. I'm doing a book, too. So
that's
great. That'll be the name of my book.
Yeah. And you were it was the last show before kind of everything closed up, right?
Oh my God.
You got pretty lucky with the timing.
Another show went up after me.
Okay.
But they didn't last long.
Yeah.
I mean, no offense to them. I actually bought one of the prints. I got lucky.
Yeah. That's pretty wild. The thing I like about your work is it's for people who aren't familiar, we'll link in the show notes so people can go check it out. But it's behind the scenes work in a certain way, but it's not what I think of when I think of like, you know, an actor on set with a camera taking like fun, cute behind the scenes photos. There's something a lot more sort of introspective about it. I think often
introspective is the key word because I'm quiet when I approach them. The Leica camera can be so quiet, not only in sound, but in the way it looks, which is the problem with the Hodinkee, because that one does create interest. I actually have, when I shoot it, depending on the situation, I have a nice black cover that I put over my Hodinkee. I do, because I don't want people looking. But other times, like if I'm having a party, I never have parties, but if I'm somewhere where I'm cool with people seeing it, I'm happy like to have it out.
Yeah.
But sometimes it's like, I want to be more discreet. Discreet, that's the word that, so when I'm on the set, if they're making contact with me with their eyes, the other actor, director, whoever, I'm okay with that. But I also look for moments where they don't even notice me. Those are the two. What I don't want and what you see in lots of photography is people sort of putting on a performative type of attitude.
Right.
The only person whose picture I took was Bob Einstein, who played Marty Funkhauser.
Yeah.
He never gave me a moment of privacy. Like he purposely made faces, purposely. So I have one in my show where he's making a face, and it might be the least face he's ever made. And it's a pretty big face.
It's a pretty good picture.
You know, he just loved doing that to me.
Is he as funny in person as it comes off?
Oh, he would make me laugh so hard that I cried sometimes. And the hardest I ever laughed on the set of Curb was we were filming a funeral scene. And as we're standing amongst all the, it's Bob's character, Bob Einstein's character's mother, I'm pretty sure. And we're all standing around getting ready to shoot this scene where someone throws Larry throws a $20 bill on the ground and everyone dives for it. Anyhow, we're standing at this funeral. Now, as we're standing there getting ready to shoot, I look over. And I see where Bob's standing, and next to him are like these four or five background extra people, you know? And they are so strange looking, I don't know what to say. I'm like, our AD had to have, Dale had to have put this together, put those people there. And I look at Larry, and I signal him to go look at Bob. And he looks at Bob, he's like, and then he sees the people. He goes, oh my God, because we're both thinking the same thing. What's gonna happen when Bob notices who's standing next to him? Because we're standing there. So literally they say, you know, sound, speed, like we're getting ready to yell action. Okay, you know, we got everything. The next word is action. And then Bob suddenly yells out. He looks at them. You see him look at them. And he goes, these are my best friends. My best friends. My mom died and they came to the funeral. Anyhow, it took us 20 minutes to collect ourselves.
That's incredible.
It was, And it was really difficult, you know. Not only is he was he a very close friend of Larry and ours and mine, but he was so essential to the show that losing him this past year on a season that we got so many accolades on is so strange, because we literally felt his absence every day. And early on, you know, he was in the hospital for pneumonia, and serious pneumonia, though. He was very sick, and I got a call from him. I'm all good. I'm going to be back in a few weeks. And we were all very happy. And then he got diagnosed like the next day with cancer, and he was dead in 2 weeks.
Wow.
And so that was a very, you know, filming comedy. But the thing is, when you're doing comedy, it's like so, it's so close to death. I know that sounds crazy, but the dealing with using comedy is so absurd in times of death that it goes hand in hand. It works, because you're trying to, it's a great place to go. Even when you're doing real comedy, it's a great place to go. I performed, and I'm not saying this as a matter of pride at all, I was stuck and I didn't cancel. The day my mom died, which was going on 4 years ago, that day, no, 3 years ago, that day, it didn't occur to me. She died in the afternoon, and it didn't occur to me that a few hours later I had a show. I could have easily called up and said, you know, I can't do it. And I was heartbroken, but, and I also went and I improvised. Like, that's what I do. I go up. All I have when I walk on stage is a song, and it's always a different song. So it reminds me to start talking about the song. I'll even just say who the song is. And that night, the night that my mom passed away and I went on stage, it was one of my best sets I ever had in my life. And I didn't talk. I mean, I don't think I talked about it. You know, I'm very honest on stage. You know, I'll talk about what's going on. I probably did. I don't remember. But I don't remember any of the set. It was, it's actually, I think I may have a recording of it somewhere. But it was death, and I was really funny.
Yeah. I think, you know, this reminds me of something I wanted to make sure to talk about with you, which is your comedy is so off the cuff, and it's improvised, and it's in the moment, and you're engaging with your audience, and you're sort of known as somebody who does, you don't have a script, you don't have stage direction, it's not all mapped out, but you are somebody who other comics bring in to help them with those things, to help tighten up writing, to help stage direction. And I wonder, like, how you split those two sort of parts of your brain, being able to tightly structure things for other people, but when it comes to your own work, it has to be kind of loose and off the cuff.
Well, I guess I would look at rock and roll people or jazz people that play that are also producers. How I play is not necessarily how I produce. It's how I direct my style in terms of for film or television. But stand up, I have to respect whoever I'm talking to. I do that stuff so behind the scenes now. Not that I wasn't behind the scenes before, but I did it with Dennis Leary and Jon Stewart and Larry David, which was Curb. So I'm respected that way, but I'm more than happy anytime sitting in a club, someone says, will you watch my set? I actually one night, this is probably half a dozen years ago, Jerry Seinfeld was coming here to play the Pantages, and I wrote him a note and I said, I want to come see you. He goes, come backstage. We'll say hello before. And I said hello. He goes, do me a favor. He goes, I never get this. Will you take notes on my set? And I did. Not many, trust me, but we sat backstage afterwards and talked about comedy for over 2 hours. Myself, him, and Jerry, and George Shapiro, his manager, who's the coolest guy. And I could talk. We talked about the differences between us and all sorts of stuff. He actually suggested that I wear a suit on stage, which I had done. You know, at that point, I had been doing comedy more than 30 years. And as a matter of fact, next month, it'll be 38 years that I've been doing stand-up. Wow. But I do now. And by the way, like, my favorite all-time band is The Clash. I have, I love the blues, I love jazz. But when I go up on stage as a comedian, there's something that feels so good and so right in wearing a suit. Now, mind you, if I go work out at the Improv or the Comedy Store, I'm going to wear a t-shirt and jeans, no problem. But a show that matters, like my special on Netflix, there's something about wearing not only a suit, but having a nice watch. Mm-hmm. And by the way, my suits, the ones that I have that are really nice, are made, was it Savile Row?
Savile Row?
Yeah. Savile Row. So were my shoes. I had shoes that were handmade. I had two suits, and I picked one, the tie, all of it. And then I had a Tag Heuer watch.
Yeah.
So am I saying it right? Tag Heuer?
Yeah, Tag Heuer, yeah.
Tag Heuer. No, it's not right. I didn't
it's close.
Right.
Come on, it's close. It's all right.
I know, but you could have corrected me.
I'm not going to give you a hard time.
Tag Heuer?
Yeah,
Heuer. Heuer.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have a, that's my nicest watch. It's a dress watch. It's a black one, like the Steve McQueen one.
Oh, yeah. The Monaco.
Yeah. The Monaco. I have a black Monaco it's like a dress Monaco. Ugh,
that's awesome.
Love it. Yeah. Love it.
I like one of the through lines I'm seeing is, you know, whether it's music or photography or comedy or even just like getting yourself ready to do comedy, right? Like you seem to be interested in process in a certain way and in craft. And is that something you've always been aware of?
Hold on. Now, remember, I've been doing this 37 years. So the answer is no, it's not something. I'm a man. Okay, I'm going to be 58 at the beginning of the month. I'm a man. I've aspired to those things, and I have learned those things. But you also know, as you said, hey, man, you go up and you improvise, you know, you off the cuff. When I act, I learn my lines if they're not improvised. If there's written thing, I learn my lines like Spencer Tracy, and I don't bump into the furniture. So in terms of approach, that may sound like not much craft, but to get to that craft as an actor, that I can do that naturally, to get to the point where I can go up on stage as a stand-up and be able to be in the moment, well, damn right, I had to learn about process and craft. And what process and craft does is it frees you. It makes things very specific, but it also frees you. For example, when I go up, I learned a craft to doing what I do. But if it all falls apart, I have to rely on my craft to have a good set, that the audience has a good time, that I've accomplished something. They don't know. The audience doesn't know whether or not that's a great show or not. I mean, I've had people tell me great shows, and I say thank you. I'm not an asshole, but I do think to myself, oh, that was okay at best, you know. And then other times I'm on fire and the audience stares at me, but that's a chemical thing with audiences. But even the craft of acting, I had to learn so much in order to be free enough to be a naturalistic actor. And so there's so much craft, and then that preparation with the craft. When I did David Letterman for the first time, I literally went to the clubs and did my 6 minutes every night, as many as I could. I'm in New York driving around. Who was I driving around with in a taxi, who also was doing Letterman? Oh, he's a brilliant comedian. He passed away. He always had these really fun way of saying things. Young guy died of heroin. I'm trying to think of his name. It's bugging me.
Mitch Hedberg?
Mitch Hedberg.
Yeah.
So Mitch and I were never great friends. We knew each other, really liked each other. So the night before his appearance, two nights before my appearance, he and I went around New York and did sets everywhere, each dinner 6 minutes, as many times as we could. I actually kept going. He actually stopped. I couldn't do it enough. Then the night of his appearance, after it was over, I stayed in the Ed Sullivan Theater and I went out on my mark and did my set. Okay. Did it in the dark. I didn't dark in the Ed Sullivan Theater. I did my set. Thank God for Zoe Friedman, who was one of the producers who allowed me to do that, you know? And so when I did the spot, you would think I'm making it up. You would think, look how loose that guy is. I put my craft and my work into looking like I was riffing and I was grooving and I had the best set of, oh my God, I don't think you could have a better set. Mm. It was a dream set. I'm so happy that I experienced that.
So you said you've been doing comedy stand up for 38 years. When
it'll be 38 years in June. Yes. Also acting, all of that.
Did acting come simultaneously with doing
stand-up?
No, stand-up?
Acting actually came before. I was a film and theater major in college. Well, I was a film major, but I took theater classes.
Okay.
And I knew like acting was a possibility and stuff. But once I auditioned, which was the week after my 20th birthday for stand-up, it was over. Mm. Like, even though I continued school and all that, it was like, no, this is it. But I knew when I was 8 years old, my parents took me to a nightclub in Chicago and I saw Jimmy Durante perform. And on the way home, I asked my parents if that was a job. I'm eight, mind you. They said, yes. I said,
that's a pretty good question for an eight-year-old.
Yeah. Well, I told them that's the job I want when they told me yes. And they laughed, not knowing that, you know, that's what was going to happen.
So Curb has now been on for 20 years. So about half your career,
yeah,
right?
It's been on for almost 20. Yeah, about half my career. But the thing about Curb is we've done 10 episodes in 20 years.
Mm. Yeah. Right. Which is,
oh, not 10, 10, not 10 episodes, 10 seasons.
Yeah. 10 seasons. Yeah. So 10 seasons in 20 years. I mean, I remember, you know, we've talked about this before, but I've been watching the whole time. My dad's a big comedy fan. And, you know, I remember, I'm going to date myself here as being stupidly young, but when Curb first came on, it was a big deal that I was like allowed to watch this show with my dad. Mm-hmm. And it's funny that through that, now still, you know, my wife and I will throw old episodes on a Friday night and have a bottle of wine. But it's funny how the show has maintained certain things. Like, there's certain things about the show that feel exactly the same, but the world is a completely different place and so much has changed. And I wonder how you guys navigate that and think about that. Producing a show for 20 years is no joke.
Well, to tell you the truth, I don't think about stuff like that. I don't. We only really thought about that, to be really honest, one season, the Fatwa season, when we'd been off the air for so many years. And I know that the fellas, Larry and Jeff Schaefer, who Jeff Schaefer holds our show together. He's a miracle worker. He's our director and directs most of the episodes. And he really holds the show together and a delight. And Larry's a delight. But I know that, I mean, I'm being really frank here. We clashed a little on the Fatwa season because I felt that we were too conscious of our show. We were trying to, it just, a lot of it's great, but it just wasn't for me, which is ironic because this past season, before we even shot a word, I already knew it was going to be my favorite season. Mm. I was like, wow, this is what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
You know, when Larry told me the idea and everything, I'm like, this is the most pure, beautiful idea because everyone's gone into a store that they go to, restaurant store, and they're treated poorly. And you go, how the fuck are you treating me poorly like this now? And they're like, I wish I could get you. Well, Larry David opens a spite store. And to me, that was gold among gold. I was so happy with that. So in general, we don't think about that stuff. And I don't know years from now how, if the Fatwa season, season number 9, if that will not hold up or hold up, I don't know. Because I also don't try figuring out why I'm funny. I don't try figuring out why Larry's funny, why the show's funny, why I don't try figuring anything out except for making it through my life on a personal basis, through my writing, through my stand-up, through whatever it is I do. That journey is what's interesting going through it. But in terms of the work, I don't analyze. Mm. I don't like it. It's not me.
Do you...
And that's any aspect of work, including my photography. Like I told you, I just took pictures for joy, and little did I know that people would go, "Oh, I love that picture." Mm. It's all, I don't get caught. Like, even my process for shooting is literally, I look at something and I go, or someone, usually someone, and I go, "Oh, I want to take a shot of that." And all I care about, the only thing I'm thinking about, is the framing, the feeling of wanting to take it, and then the framing, to make sure the framing is the way I want it. Other than that, I'm not thinking of how the picture is going to turn out. I'm not thinking anything. As a matter of fact, even with digital photography, see, a lot of people shoot, I shoot film too. Mm-hmm. I love them. I touch my favorite camera is the MP. But when I shoot film, by the time I take it in and by the time it's developed, the rolls, it could be 6 months. Well, I don't go that extreme with SD cards, but no kidding around, with SD cards, I'll wait 2 to 3 weeks at least before I look at what I've shot digitally, because that takes away the emotional connection to whatever photo I took.
Yeah.
Any emotional connection, because I want to eliminate that. Even so, even in photography, I try and do that. I try and be, as a human being and as an artist, pure, like as pure as I can be.
Yeah.
And be humble. I'm very confident. I'm more confident in other skills that I have, you know, but I like the aspirations to be pure and humble.
Mm. I think, you know, as we talk about this, I think it's interesting that, you know, we're talking about Curb and it flows pretty seamlessly into your photography. And that's something I've noticed about a lot of your passions, is they tend to overlap and kind of cross with one another. So, you know, your love of music and your love of photography. I know you're a big Jim Marshall fan. You know, your love of
Jim Marshall's my biggest inspiration, for sure.
Yeah. And your love of photography and obviously filmmaking. You know, you produced the Vivian Meyer documentary a couple of years ago. Yeah. You know, music, yeah, and collecting, you collect guitars, like these things tend to kind of like overlap and weave with one another. Is that something you're doing consciously at all, or is it just kind of a byproduct of your process?
I'm just me, and it's a byproduct of whatever my process is. Like, I already know how I'm going to play guitar when I play guitar in my stand-up. Now, I came to this realization, and it kind of depressed me about a month ago. Not terribly, because I've been okay without doing stand-up for the first time in my life, but that's because I was burnt out. I had filmed Goldberg's Curb Your Enthusiasm, put together my photo show, and prepped and shot a stand-up special all within like 1 year of complete work. So I was ready to take time. I was planning on taking time off anyhow. It's gone far longer than any of us wanted, but I'm well rested and I'm ready to do creative things. But I have to say that everything that I do, sort of, I'm just true to me. And if it interests me and makes me feel good, then I go with it, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know if I even answered your
question. No, that's perfect. You know, we've also
But there's no conscious. Oh, the music in my show. That's,
yeah,
I knew that. I always know when I forget something. So what I'm going to do, and I don't care if anyone, this is the only place I'm ever going to talk about it. Perfect. I'm not talking about it because I'm a big fan of just doing stuff. But it's fun to just tell you, and whoever your listeners are can be on the secret. So there were two things. One is, I came to the realization about a month ago that I won't be doing stand-up for probably at least 6 months, maybe a year, because I cannot perform with people with masks that are sit separately. I understand that's how it has to be. So I'm not someone who goes against that. And I am aware of, from now until the end of time, there's always going to be a few people everywhere you go who will be wearing masks. Just, it's going to be, someone will be paranoid, someone will be ill. There's many different reasons people are going to be, that's okay. And I'll never judge that or make fun of them. But for my style of comedy, I need a crowded room and I need to see people's faces and hear them laugh. So until that happens, I won't do stand up. So I won't do stand up again until we're at that place, which will be, but we just don't know when, but I'm comfortable with that. But when I do, because I had my Netflix special, like I'm due, actually it won't be now till next summer, I'm due to do a tour of some sort. Mm. And when I do, what I've decided to do for my next tour, whenever that is, so I have plenty of time to learn. but I'm going to, there's a I'm going to have on stage probably one of my favorite Fender Telecaster. Gibsons are don't take a beating. Like I said, they're works of art. They also don't take a beating. Whereas not, Leicas take a beating. Gibsons, they're not super sensitive. You can travel, but truly a Fender is like a weapon. Yeah. I mean, a Telecaster, don't fight somebody with a Telecaster. You're going to lose. So anyhow, I'll have my Telecaster on stage, little amp, and I'm going to do my stand-up set. I'm never going to refer to it. Even during Q&A part, I'm not going to refer to it. I say goodnight. I walk off. I'll count to five, probably. People have started to leave. I'm going to walk out, sit down on a little stool next to the guitar, pick it up, turn on the amp, and I'm going to play the song Boogie Chillin' by John Lee Hooker. Yeah. And I'm going to play it straight, and I'm going to sing it straight, except for the fact that I'm going to do like a John Lee Hooker voice, but I'm not going to make my, it's something like this. This is John Lee Hooker, this is the way he talks and the way he sings. So I'm going to sing the song like this in a boogie chillin', and I'm not going to draw attention to it. So I'm going to do the song, play it straight with great respect to one of my heroes, John Lee Hooker, boom, leave the stage.
I love
and
that.
I'm not going to say a word about it. That is the way that I will play guitar in my act. I have a couple of acoustics, more a bunch of electrics. I'm not here to do song parodies. I'm not here to do sing-alongs. I want to do boogie chilling. Not that if anyone wants to sing along, that's their business. But that's what I'm going to do. So that's my approach. But for me, I love the blues. That's a very naturalistic way for me to include. And it's different. And it's at the very end. And so, yeah, that's the way I think about things. They just have to come.
I love when you say that your style of comedy requires being able to see people's faces and being able to interact with people and being in a crowded room. And I think that's something that in your photography, we see how you do that on a set. It's very clear from your photo. I mean, I've never been on set with you. I've never seen you act in you know, with cameras. But it's really clear that you're interacting with people. It's a very interactive thing. You're not up there on your own doing a monologue. You're playing off of people. You're interacting. You're kind of reading what's going on, and you're engaged.
It's kind of like, I mean, photography is kind of like a dance.
Yeah.
And either the person wants to dance or they don't want to dance. If they don't want to dance, you've got to catch them at the right time. And if they do want to dance, you got to make sure that they don't go too crazy and embarrass you on the dance floor. I just want everyone around me to just be the way they are. But the advantage that I have, see, I used to want to be like Brisson, be this great street photographer. Well, I go out on the street, my head is gigantic, and a good portion of people are going to know who I am. It's no good.
Yeah, it doesn't work.
When I'm on the set, I'll use Larry David as an example. Larry David, you know, he doesn't really love set photographers. Doesn't hate them. He's okay. But when I have my camera, considering I have it all the time, he's just calm. He's not doing anything or showing me anything that's not uniquely 100% him. And I just take the pictures, and he's got a comfort level, which most people who work with me have a comfort level because they know me. I'm friends with them. Mm. Or even that friend, I'm their coworker. It's not unusual. And it's and I show everyone great respect. I don't get into their what they're working. I don't want to catch. See, what I don't want to get is what a behind the scenes photographer wants to get, which is the scene from behind the scenes, or the process of like an actor getting ready or discussing. I mean, I've taken those pictures, but I don't have much interest in those pictures. I want to just capture a moment that no one else will see. Mm. And not that other people do see them preparing for a scene, an actress and a director, what have you. But I want just this moment in time. And so funny, Christy Brinkley did an episode of The Goldbergs.
Yeah.
And I loved her. She is as sweet on the inside as she is beautiful on the outside. And she's just remarkable. And I had the best time with her. Well, whenever I pulled out my camera, she did something I've never seen before. she was Christie Brinkley. She'd move her head. She was supermodel Christie Brinkley. And then it occurred to me after I'd looked at the pictures and taken all the pictures, that's her place of comfort. Mm. You know, that's when the camera's up, that's who she is.
Yeah.
And that was 100% unique for her. And I have a picture for her on the old, because of the episode we were filming, the National Lampoon's Vacation, the red car that she drove in the movie. Well, I have her on the front hood, and the way she's looking is almost like a pose, but that's her being natural, very natural. So anytime we were near a fan, man, I pull out the camera where other people aren't even noticing, she starts using the fan to blow her hair. It was like, but that was her in a natural, it sounds like almost like I'm doing like a National Geographic. That's her natural setting.
Yeah, right.
But that's what it is. That's where she's comfortable. And I was happy capturing her where she was most happy and comfortable.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So you're, you know, before we wrap things up, there's a couple things I want to make sure we cover. You know, we talked about what you're collecting sort of like ethos is and your process of collecting. But I wonder, you know, you said you collect guitars, you collect watches to a lesser extent, cameras. What are sort of, you know, in your various categories, what are sort of the dream things that you're still searching for, the things that keep you kind of motivated to keep searching?
Okay. Well, I can do, see, there's not much, look, baseball cards. I love old Chicago Cubs. I love Sandy Koufax. I love Hank Aaron. So for me, buying, it's not as much. Although prior to the whole Jordan piece thing that was on TV, I actually said, screw it, I'm going to get a Michael Jordan rookie card. I bought a Michael Jordan rookie card, mint. It went up from, I don't even know what it is now, but it went up $3,000 in only a few weeks.
Jeez.
But that one is not one that because I lived through that in Chicago, that's all good that it went up, but I'm not, I have other cards and other guitars and stuff that are worth more that emotionally I'm cool with selling. But my dream guitar, I already own. That's a 1953 Fender Telecaster, a Blackguard. Gibson's making me a copy of the ES-335 guitar that Eric Clapton played for a thing that I hosted them for them. So I mean, I'm excited about that. I have behind me here, I'm going to, does it do the reverse thing here? Yeah. All right, hold on. In my room here, right over there, that guitar, Buddy Guy signed that for me at his Club Legends. We had a great, I mean, I'm not friends with Buddy Guy, but I know him. And he told me, I expect you to play that. So, and he signed it. And so that I treasure. As far as watches, I have that beautiful Tag Heuer. But for me, I want to get some Rolexes, old Rolexes. Yeah. That's like, do I want a goal as a goal? Yeah, that's a goal. And I happen to have a great friend that collects them and has them. He'd be very helpful. I want like the best in some Submariner, you know, watch.
We can help you out there.
Oh, really?
Yeah, well, I'll help you find something good.
Oh, really?
We'll talk after we turn the mics off, and I'll help you find something.
Oh,
good.
Look at you and your good looks.
Yeah.
Wow. And to me, by the way, one of the things about watches that I love is not just buying them randomly because I'm doing well, you know, but I like to say, I like to celebrate by buying a watch. A watch to me is of all the collectibles, I bought that watch when I.
Yeah.
You know, when I filmed this, when I sold this, when I met her or whatever, I love that about watches. So you can tie in something beautiful with something beautiful.
Yeah.
And my cameras, I now am 100% in the, I got rid of my last Leica M4, which was my favorite all-time one, because I don't like using a light meter in my hand. Mm. I like that it's built in the camera because everything else is manual.
Yeah.
So I don't collect cameras anymore. I mean, the Hodinkee one is kind of a collectible. It is a collectible, but it's more a tool that I'm using.
Okay.
So for me, it's all about tools. Same with if I get a Rolex. It's got to work.
Yeah.
And it's got to serve the purpose of what I'm wearing it for.
Yeah.
And I'm not wearing it for people to come over and look at. I'm wearing because it'll look good with what I'm wearing. It'll serve the purpose of what I'm doing. Like, I wouldn't want on my wrist a little watch where I can't really read the hands without looking at it on stage, because I want to be able to look at it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, we do a little questionnaire usually to wrap things up. So I'm going to ask you a couple quick fire questions, and then we'll give people some directions on what they can go check out of yours after after they're done listening. So,
okay.
I guess the first question would be, are there any watches that have caught your eye recently? Anything you've sort of noticed and been interested in?
Oh, yes. It was beautiful. It was a anniversary of some sort, and I may have seen it in the new Hodinkee magazine. I don't remember what it is offhand. Yes, but yes,
all right.
Always.
Yeah. what's the best place you traveled in the last year?
Did I travel in the last year? That's the question. I traveled all over. I didn't do a lot of traveling this past year compared. Always my favorite place to go is New York or London. I love living in Los Angeles. I love Chicago because that's where I'm from. But New York and London are my two favorites. I love going to Paris. I love going to any, I mean, with my photo show, what I'm hoping is, because I know the next showing of the show I just did in Los Angeles is going to be in Chicago. Then I believe Boston, maybe Miami, but I want to go to Europe with it too.
Yeah.
I want to go to Germany. I want to go to France. Like, I want to go all over with it. So
that'd be great.
Yeah.
Cool.
But specifically, maybe my bed was the most interesting place I visited.
What's your guilty pleasure?
I have no guilty pleasures. For example, I don't eat sugar, so there's no pleasure in that. I guess, all right, if there was a guilty pleasure, it's watching mediocre action movies.
Okay.
Bad action movies, unless they're horrible and they're funny, not fun. But I'll enjoy a good, mediocre action movie. Not even good. I'll enjoy. That would be a guilty pleasure.
That counts.
Because I'd rather be doing something more productive. My favorite thing to watch is English procedurals. I love any English TV show that, you know, is based on a cop or a detective.
Perfect.
Figuring out just the way the English do it. I love it. Love it.
Perfect.
So, but that's not a guilty pleasure. That's, I've like studied all of them. And my next TV show that I'm going to do for me, I'm going to be a detective. I've got
awesome.
One, which it may be along that line. It's called Handsome. It's on Netflix, a movie that I made.
Great.
Yeah.
What's the best piece of advice you've ever been given, and who gave it to you?
Well, I've made up, here's the thing, it's going to sound so egotistical. I've made up some that I'm very proud of. Like,
that's allowed.
Well, that's not what I'm going to do. But I tell my children, take what you do seriously, don't take yourself seriously. That's one that I'm very proud of, per se. And someone else, I'm sure, throughout mankind has said that. But my father, don't believe the hype. My dad was a big believer in not believing the hype. Don't think you're great. As a guy who just quoted himself for the best advice. But my dad said, don't believe the hype. Do not.
Great.
So I don't. I don't believe the hype.
Great.
And that makes me, every time I do something like this, I'm honored to be here, even though we're separate and we're not even in the same room. I'm honored to be on with you. I'm honored that you wanted to spend even a minute with me, and I thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, this is a ton of fun for me. I'm very happy to be here too. So, all right. The last thing I'm going to ask you, actually, I'm going to ask you two more. The last standard question is, What do you have a cultural recommendation? A TV show, a book, a movie, something you recommend people go check out? Something you've really enjoyed lately?
Well, I'll just come up something that I really enjoyed lately, like just randomly. A movie called Arkansas, which is on pay-per-view, which I just adored. I loved it. Arkansas. Perfect. So there you go.
Great. And then the last question I'm going to ask you is a special one, because I know you're a Chicago guy. And as somebody who's lived in Chicago, I feel like this is an appropriate question. Do you have a favorite dive bar in Chicago?
Oh, well, that's interesting. First off, yes and no. Me, I don't drink.
Okay.
Well, actually, I shouldn't say that. I have probably 2 to 3 beers a year.
Okay.
I have 2 to 3 glasses of wine a year. I swear, and these are not things I even plan for. They come up, whatever.
Yeah.
And I only had this past year, no exaggeration, my first cocktail.
Okay.
So, but in terms of dive bar, there's only one in Chicago that is the real deal. And it's been there since the 50s. To me, I'm talking about for someone, a comedic person. And that's called the Old Town Ale House in Old Town in Chicago. It's on North Avenue near Wells Street, right by Second City and Zanies. And I'll find myself when I go back to Chicago, even though I'm not a drinker, I'll find myself at least once at the Old Town Ale House.
Great.
That is the best, quote, dive bar in Chicago to
Perfect.
Me.
Great. Well, then the last thing I want to do is we'll do a little bit of log rolling.
Okay.
People should go check out your special on Netflix, which we've talked about. It's Our Man in Chicago.
Yep.
It's fantastic. They should go watch the latest season of Curb, which is available digitally on every one of HBO's like 9 million platforms that they have now.
Yeah. It's gone all over now. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the last thing I want people to know about is that they can get prints of your photos through Leica Gallery LA, and your side of the proceeds go to your charity, which is Fuck Cancer, right?
Yes, sir. Yes, to Fuck Cancer, which makes me, I'm on the board. I have a board meeting tomorrow.
Amazing.
For Fuck Cancer. It's fun to say I have a Fuck Cancer board meeting. But I also want to say, because I just built this with, I have a marketing person. I have a website, jeffgarland.com, and you can sign up on there. Just put your email in and I'll write once a month. The first one's coming out this June.
Great.
Next week, actually, I'm sending out my first letter of what's going on and what you can look forward to. And so if you dig me, everything's at jeffgarland.com.
Perfect. We'll link that up in the show notes so people can go right there. They can just click right through.
Thank you.
Awesome.
Thank you.
This was great, Jeff. I really appreciate it. I'm glad we were able to connect, and we'll have to do this again soon.
We will. We have no choice.
Awesome. Thanks, Jeff. Have a good one.
Thank you too.
Thanks. This week's episode was recorded remotely by our group of editors and was produced and edited by Grayson Korhonen. Please remember to subscribe and rate the show. It really does make a difference for us. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.